This podcast is brought to you by the IIEA, sharing ideas, shaping policy.
Hello, and welcome to Democracy in the United States in the Year of Elections, an IIEA webinar. My name is Barry Colfer, and I'm the Director of Research here at the Institute, and I want to thank you all for being with us, or indeed for watching back after the fact. Discussing democracy and elections is always important, but it feels all the more urgent to do so in 2024, when more than 4 billion people are eligible to vote in elections, including in the likes of the United States, India, the UK, South Africa, Mexico, and many more, including, of course, ourselves, with the European and local elections forthcoming in June. I want to give a very warm welcome to our speaker, Vanessa Williamson. Vanessa is a senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings, and is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Centre. Vanessa studies taxation, redistribution, democracy, and political participation, and is the author, along with Theda Skopkvall, of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. Vanessa is going to speak to us for about 20 minutes on this subject of democracy in the US in this year of elections, before we'll move to Q&A with you, our audience. Both the presentation and our discussions will be on the record as ever, and you can contribute to the debate using the Twitter X handle at IIEA. Without further ado, Vanessa, thank you again very much for being with us, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you for the kind introduction, and thank you for the invitation. I'm so glad to be here. So I'm going to talk today about democratic erosion in the United States and the upcoming 2024 election. So I think when people think about democratic erosion in the United States, both here and abroad, I imagine that we think about the 2020 and 2021, when the sitting president, despite admitting privately that he had lost the election, attempted to subvert the election results and remain in office. Of course, the very striking visual images of our Capitol being overrun by rioters, along with other efforts to alter the vote count. And, you know, those should be at the forefront of our mind. It was certainly a shocking incident for American citizens. But the point I want to make in this talk is to talk about the problems with American democracy that are beyond the problems with one candidate. So although the 2022 elections, our midterm elections, occurred largely without incident, which was wonderful, there is not really in the United States currently a bipartisan consensus on the rules of the game that transfer power. And so that's obviously a very concerning state of the world from a political science perspective. And so I'm going to provide a little bit of background about the sort of longer term issues that are facing the United States. But first, I'm just going to sort of categorize the kinds of democratic erosion that are occurring here. And I should say, I'm going to focus specifically on the parts of democratic erosion that are occurring within our state institutions, right? So you can talk about the decline of media in the United States, you know, local media in the United States. There are a lot you can talk about, polling data and people's affect towards the out party. There are a lot of things you can talk about in the context of democratic decline. I'm just going to talk about the institutions today, in part because I think the evidence is pretty strong that, you know, the fish is rotting from the head, I'm afraid. That is to say that it is political leaders who have led, who have sort of caused the decline, the democratic erosion that's occurring in the United States, rather than the populace having a sudden shift of opinion and leaders responding to that. So the two kinds of democratic erosion that I'm going to talk about are, first of all, the strategic manipulation of elections, right? And so to be clear, and this may be something that's irrelevance for an audience, but in the United States, there's sometimes talk about, quote, voter fraud, that's to say voter impersonation, that you would pretend to be a voter and then go vote. That basically doesn't exist. That's not a real thing. But there is effort to manipulate election procedures, and that's really significant. So, for example, there are places that have seen substantial cuts to the number of polling places there are, which makes it hard for people in certain communities to vote. There have been state-level efforts to require certain kinds of identification that only some Americans have, making, again, harder for certain communities to vote. And then also the sort of classic maneuvers, things like gerrymandering that change the boundaries of boundaries of representation in a way that gives one party or the other a substantial advantage, right? So those are the kinds of things I mean by strategic manipulation of elections. So that's one piece, and it gets a lot of attention in the United States for good reason. The other piece, I think, is coming to the fore more now as a serious issue. Although, and frankly, it's been the sort of underlying pieces of it have been in place for a long time. And it's what we call executive aggrandizement, right? And this is the idea that even a legitimately elected leader, you can win an election and still undermine democracy if what you do is, while in power, eliminate checks and balances, consolidate power among party loyalists, and sort of do things that make the next election unfair. So executive aggrandizement is an issue in the United States. Obviously, we have sort of three main components of our federal system. We have the executive, including the president, the legislature, Congress, and the judiciary. And the power of Congress has seriously diminished in recent years. The power of the executive has grown, and I'll talk a little more about this, where the judiciary lies on that. So these are the two issues, right? We've got the voting issue, we've got executive aggrandizement. But before I start talking about things that have happened in the last 10 years or so, right, where we've seen a really substantial decline in any international measure you want to look at, in the quality of American democracy, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the broader context, right? Because we have a funny system here. There are many longstanding aspects of governance in the United States that are not particularly democratic, not the way most countries that want to be a democracy set up their institutions anymore. And also some things that are that you know the people who founded our country would have seen as dangerous to civil liberties. So in our Constitution, there are two aspects that are sort of startling, I think, for people who are if you were going to design a democracy, it might not be what you'd choose these days. One, we have a bicameral legislature where the upper house actually has quite a lot of power. So our Senate has two seats per state, and our states are of very different sizes. I think it's always worth remembering how different they are. So our largest state is California, which has 39 million people. It's where I'm from. Our smallest state is Wyoming. It has 600,000. And both of those states have two seats in our Senate, which means that the people of Wyoming are represented at a rate of 66 to 1. So we also have a house that is arranged by population, plus or minus a little bit. But this is a huge mismatch between the population and the representatives. And the Senate is a powerful institution, as we can talk more about. Of course, our presidential elections are also skewed to a small extent by this because we have an electoral college that takes account of the Senate in terms of its numbers. But the real issue with our electoral college is that our states vote for our president. And as a rule, the states have a winner-take-all system, which means that if you win the state of California by one vote, you get all of California's electoral votes, which means that there are often very large mismatches between the electoral count and the actual population, the voting population. And of course, sometimes that results in the candidate who didn't get the most votes winning, which we've seen a couple of times in recent years. Okay. There are two other historical aspects of American democracy that are, again, a little bit at odds with how I think, political scientists would recommend setting up a democracy today. One of them is the filibuster, and this exists in the Senate, and it basically allows a minority as small as one to prevent legislation from moving forward if the legislation can't get 60 votes behind it. And there's some exceptions to that rule. But it means that the veto power of the Senate, again, this deeply misproportioned institution, is very powerful. The other thing that is sort of a significant part of the American longstanding American practice, this both the filibuster and judicial supremacy date to the 19th century, is the idea that our Supreme Court has the final word on whether something is constitutional, and there is not an obvious way to there's not a system that exists that overrules the Supreme Court on questions of constitutionality. So as questions of constitutionality become really central to our discussions, the final arbiter of that is an appointed a life a set of people with a lifetime appointment, so not a particularly democratic system. Right. So we have these very long-standing historical issues that are not particularly democratic, but what you can't really describe as democratic erosion except on a very long time scale, right? But the other thing, well, oh, I should say, and there are two things on the civil liberties front that are worth remembering. One, of course, is that we have an enormous military in this country. It is the most expensive military in the world, hands down, by a factor of several. I can't even remember at the moment. And also, we have an unusually strong presidency. And I'll get back to that question when we talk about executive aggrandizement. The last thing I'll say about American democracy is we are a very old republic. We have been a republic since our founding. But we are a very new democracy by any reasonable standard, right? Because we did not have universal suffrage in this country until 1965, with the passage of the Voting Rights Act that finally reenfranchised Black Americans in the American South, right? So when we think about whether we are an old democracy or a new one, I think you could actually argue it both ways, right? We had subnational authoritarian enclaves that operated as one party states for 100 years, and that only ended in the lived experience of many older Americans today. Okay, I should say that in many ways, if we're talking about the democratic erosion that's occurring now, it is reasonable to see that as a continuation of the backlash to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, right? So you see some of the ways in which democracy is eroding today are replicating or echoing some of that earlier politics. And here I'm thinking both about the limitations on voting rights, but also the expansion of our policing and incarceration state, which, in addition to obviously, destroying the lives and livelihoods of people who are incarcerated, remove them from the civil, from civil life. And it can, in many cases, felons are often disenfranchised. And so it actually has an effect because mass incarceration is so high in this country, it actually does have effect on who gets to vote that, is substantial enough to affect election outcomes. Okay. Finally, I'll just say a little bit about the international context, but I know I'm among experts on that. So once upon a time, I would say 15 years ago, Ireland and the United States looked about the same on these measures. Ireland has, of course, continued to look superb on international measures of democracy, while we have seen sort of a really substantial decline. What does that mean in practice? The Economist calls us a flawed democracy now, which puts us in the same category as places like Italy and Israel. We're just sort of a second tier, right? We're out of the top 10% in the variety of democracy scale, for example. So there is, it's a really substantial change. And I think it's something that Americans are only just grappling with, the idea that we are sort of the beacon of democracy that we would like to imagine ourselves to be. Okay, I'm going to talk for a few more minutes just about those two specific issues. So I'm going to talk about the strategic manipulation of elections, and I'm going to talk about executive aggrandizement. And then I'll wrap it up and we can get to the more fun part for me, which is the questions, right? All right, so elections in the United States are very heavily controlled at a state and local level. I think that is another thing that can be a bit startling for people from other countries. We have federal election laws, and in fact, federal election law was key to the success of the civil rights movement that I mentioned earlier. Federal election laws, what was the implementation of those laws is what returned, voting rights to universal suffrage levels in the South. But election administration happens at a state or local level, and because so much of election outcomes are really about the administration, right? About who gets to vote, how easy it is for them to vote. We have a system now where the states are diverging democratically, right? So there's international measures that we can use to look at the United States versus other countries. We also have measures within the United States looking at our states. And what we're seeing is there's a divergence. Some states are improving their democracy. So some states reacted very well in 2020 to making sure that people could still vote. Obviously, we were having an election in the middle of a pandemic. And, a lot of states made enormous progress here, making vote by mail very easy, extending early voting, and sort of coping with a crisis in a way that was quite impressive, frankly, as an observer. But about half of states are going in the other direction. They are making it harder to vote. They are gerrymandering more. They are reducing polling places. They are, they're just putting obstacles in place that systematically, they don't legally disenfranchise people. But what the systematic effect is that people do not get the opportunity to vote at the same rate. So there's a wonderful political scientist named Jake Grumbach here in the United States who's tried to quantify this, and he's created something called the State Democracy Index, which takes account of all these different factors, things like polling place wait times, red tape voter registration, another very big issue. So we have a voter registration process that in some states regularly removes people from the rolls and they wouldn't necessarily know, and gerrymandering, things like that. So Grumbach finds that some of our states are experiencing very serious democratic backsliding, and significantly, where it's happening is not places that are particularly polarized per se. It's places where there is Republican control of the state government, and this has been, this is a finding that's very consistent across a bunch of other things. If you look at where voter ID laws went into effect, those are places with Republican government, and so the dynamic is really, particularly Republican governments where their control of the government would be contested or is sort of close, this is where you're seeing these new laws go into place. Right. So that's strategic manipulation of elections. And I should say the Democrats are absolutely willing to engage in a certain amount of the sort of gerrymandering style of election manipulation, and always have. But at the moment, the sort of the more extreme version of that is really coming from the Republican Party. All right, executive aggrandizement. So this, of course, is the idea that you can have a perfectly successful election and the candidate who gets the most votes can win and so forth. And then that candidate, that now president, I suppose in our case, would consolidate power, right? Would eliminate the checks and balances of the other branches, would eliminate the independence of the civil service, and would undermine the independence authority of the judiciary. And this is something that is a serious issue in the United States, in part because of the role the president plays anyway, right? The president is a very powerful role in the United States. It's a presidential system. But it's something that happened substantially more under the Trump administration. It's something that is widely expected to recur if Trump were to be even, you know, legitimately reelected. So you'll remember some of these stories, but Trump worked very hard to delegitimize and incapacitate different parts of our civil service, right? I mean, most obviously in the Justice Department, where investigations of criminal activity within the Trump administration, he attempted to sort of spike those, right? But it happened in a lot of other things too. So, for example, our health administration reports on COVID were altered, or at least they attempted to alter those to make the numbers look better, I suppose, one way or another. Entire bureaus were uprooted and moved to new states. And, you know, that's, we're talking about like 2 or 3,000 miles away, which has the effect, obviously, since people who work in government have lives and families, of, you know, basically eliminating all, you know, senior people and most of the junior people too, instead of completing, you know, allowing for basically a complete restaffing of the agency. Looking forward, both the Trump campaign and the Heritage Foundation, which is a very central conservative think tank, pretty long standing here in the United States, have proposed, you know, openly proposed policies in a new Republican administration that would drastically reduce the independence of the civil service. So Trump released right at the end, this was almost completely unnoticed at the time because so many other things were happening at the same time, but right at the end of his administration, he released an executive order called Schedule F. Which proposed to give him the authority to fire as many as 50,000 civil servants. Right, so this would very substantially undermine the independence of those institutions. And there's the Heritage Foundation has released a document called Project 2025, which is intended for any Republican president going forward, that that sort of consistently aims to politicize the civil service and also to undermine its independence. Okay. So given this sort of the direction of within the executive branch, what do we think the other branches can do? Unfortunately, our Congress is pretty poorly positioned to put a serious check on executive authority, in part because the level of dysfunction in Congress is so very high. Our various speaker fights may have made the news. I'm not sure, but we have, yeah, which there was a certain amount of it reached a level of absurdity that was in some sense funny, but it was actually, of course, not funny, right? That we can't form sort of a governing coalition even within the Republican Party to run the United States House of Representatives, and so that's an ongoing issue. So the power of Congress has really eroded. For over a long period of time, and particularly at the moment, where the parties now, even when they have majority control, have a very hard time getting their top priorities through. And you can see this on the Republican and on the Democratic side. So Democrats, for example, when they had unified control, their first piece of legislation they introduced was the For the People Act, which was a voting rights reform act, would have done a number of very good things to protect against some of the issues of election manipulation that I mentioned. They couldn't get it done. Similarly, the Republican Party came into office at one point dead set on overturning Obamacare, which you may remember, the Affordable Care Act that expanded health insurance under the Obama administration. They came in dead set. I mean, it was the top campaign promise to overturn Obamacare. And they couldn't, even with unified control, couldn't get it done. So there's really fundamental dysfunction and gridlock in Congress that leaves the institution quite poorly positioned, I think, to act as a check on the executive, even if they chose to do so, which in the case of unified party control would be, of course, less likely. Now, the legislature, on the other hand, our judiciary is quite powerful, and has grown more powerful over time. So while we've seen Congress's authority decline in a lot of ways, the Supreme Court's authority has increased. Sort of a good marker of that was the 2000 case, Bush v. Gore, which determined the outcome of the presidential election. Previously, when we've had a contested outcome of the presidential election, it was the House of Representatives that made the decision. But in this case, it was decided by a lawsuit. So there was a real shift of authority there that I think is pretty fundamental. Now, so the Supreme Court's quite powerful. So in that sense, they can act as a powerful check on the executive, though they don't have enforcement powers, right? But the Supreme Court has grown substantially more partisan and conservative in recent years. And this, again, is something that you can see very clearly just in straightforward political science data. The skew of the court is quite far to the right at the moment, which has led many people to, in fact, most Americans doubt that Supreme Court decisions are made based on law. They think it's made based on politics now. So the court is, on the one hand, quite conservative and quite associated with the Republican Party. Of course, Trump got to nominate an unusual number of Supreme Court justices. And then the other important fact to keep in mind is that the Supreme Court has substantially narrowed voting rights protections. So I talked about those major pieces of legislation in the 1960s that, the Voting Rights Act that expanded suffrage to, to the, return voting rights to Black Americans. Those laws have been whittled down. And I can talk a little bit more about specifically how that happened, which I think is really interesting. But the Supreme Court has really narrowed the scope of election protections that exist, and I think has shown at least some interest in allowing for a reduction of civil service independence. And so there, I wouldn't, I don't think that a reasonable observer would look at the Supreme Court as though it were going to provide as strong of a protection as it sort of it might if you just looked at the strength of the institution compared to Congress. So that's my quick review of democratic erosion in the United States. I'm happy to take some questions.
This podcast is brought to you by the IIEA, sharing ideas, shaping policy.